You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
It feels like going back in time, doesn't it? Where are we, Lionel?
We're outside the National Theatre on London's South Bank, our old home venue, wasn't it, for many a week, many a month. And first return here for a little while. It signals to me that the road racing season at least is beginning to wind down, and autumn is certainly upon us now, isn't it?
Well, it's freezing.
It's freezing, and but confusingly, there's a helicopter above us, which makes me think that there must be a bike race nearby. Maybe a peloton's going to sweep past us here in the South Bank.
I think the Extinction Rebellion peloton are blocking one of the bridges over there.
Is that what that is?
There's been a bit of a barrage over there.
Oh dear!
Extinction Rebellion, but. Rebellin, Davide Rebellin, is still not extinct. I think he's going to ride next year for a Hungarian team. He might even be at the Giro.
Extinction Rebellin is something
quite
different.
How old is Rebellin now?
He's born in 1971, I think. I think August 1971, off the top of my head.
So
almost 50.
Yeah.
Wow. I was wondering whether he would switch to esports just for the sunset of his racing career and would become a sensation. Indoor static
cycling.
Well, it's
funny you should mention that, because I think he did he not ride some of the e-Giro, which is the Giro on electric bikes,
but that's outdoors and actually moving.
Actual
the Giro on e's.
Factual e-cycling rather than virtual e-cycling.
Well, funny you should mention that, though, isn't it? Because that has been in the news. What have we got coming up this week, Lionel?
Well, Rich, we've got three big talking points in this episode of the Cycling Podcast. In the first part, we're going to talk about Giorgio Squinzi, who was the long-time sponsor of the MAPPE team, certainly one of the best teams of the 20th century. Daniel has a lot of information about the history of the MAPPE team. He died last week at the age of 76. In the second part, we'll be hearing from Graham Bartlett, the CEO of Velon, about the Hammer Series and their dispute with the UCI. Richard and Daniel, you both went and met Graham Bartlett last week, so we'll hear that. The Hammer Series Hong Kong race, which was due to be held this weekend, has been cancelled because of protests in Hong Kong, not deemed to be safe to hold a bike race there at the moment. And in the final part, we'll talk about the controversy in esports and the British esports the British esports championship didn't take place on a real road.
We're also going to talk about Il Lombardia, aren't we? Look ahead to the last monument of the season at the weekend. A bit more racing. And there has been a little bit of racing, hasn't there?
There has been some racing, yes. Alvaro Hodge won the Munsterland Giro and then came to grief in the final lap or the final straight of the Tour de l'Euro Métropole. Had a pretty nasty crash there. Other racing in Italy leading up to
Munsterland, did you see the punch-up?
Oh yeah, the punch-up. Sorry, how could I miss the punch-up? Florian Senechal came to blows. Daniel, your man, long predicted Paris-Roubaix winner, Senechal.
Was this part of the plan?
Max Walscheid is another of my pet projects. I've been waiting to come good for a few years. So yeah, they had it out, didn't they?
Is this a kind of knockout for your affections?
Yeah, I think so.
You can only champion one of them going forward. Quite a bit of racing in Italy leading up to Il Lombardia at the weekend. Sonny Colbrelli won the Grand Prix Bruno Beghelli, and Primoz Roglic won the Giro dell'Emilia on the same climb where he won the opening time trial of the Giro d'Italia in Bologna. That's right, isn't it?
Correct. No,
and he scorched up there. He went even quicker than he did in the time trial, I gather.
Yeah, I don't think he quite got the record, did he, for the San Luca climb? But very impressive. He won by over 10 seconds, didn't he? Looks in good nick, does old Rog, ahead of Tour of Lombardy.
After seeing him in the mix zone in Harrogate after the World Championships, where he got in that early break and then climbed off when they reached the circuit, I thought that was his season done and dusted. They all looked cold and miserable, but he looked like a man who'd done enough for 2019, but clearly not.
Talking of climbs, Napalm, and the Emilia-Romagna region, that was also where Beghelli was. I don't know that much about the GP Beghelli. I've never been to that race, but I was reading about the history of the climb that basically decides that race, the Zappolino climb. It was the scene of a famous battle, the Battle of the Stolen Bucket, in the Middle Ages. This could turn into a very convoluted tangent, but I'm not going to go there.
This is already a meandering version of the news roundup. But who was Bruno Beghelli? Do you know?
I don't know. But I know about the stolen bucket.
Well, we'll have to.
Beghelli, no, I don't actually. I have known at some point in the past, but I've forgotten.
Oh my God, this is like the time you asked if you like vermouth. It's the only time you've been stumped.
Your mission for 2020, Daniel, is by the time of the next edition, you can tell us who Bruno Beghelli
I know about,
was.
Yeah. I also know about the Battle of the Stolen Bucket. It was also the subject of a famous poem by... I know about the poet who wrote it, Alessandro Tassoni.
I'd actually like Daniele Friberincini here, which he's now called, to go and... taking all these Italian autumn classics next year for a French special. They're really fascinating and beautiful races to watch, aren't they?
They are, and as we've said before, they've been given a bit of a new lease of life by basically a rare incidence of sort of coherent calendar planning. They've all been sort of grouped together, whereas once upon a time they were sort of dispersed before and after the World Championships, but now it makes a nice block of racing, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, they used to be the kind of selection races for the Italian World Championship team, didn't they, after the Tour de France, running sort of through August, and then there was another little flurry just before Il Lombardia. But you're right, this kind of lead up to Il Lombardia is good. One man who looks good for Il Lombardia, I think, is Adam Yates, who won the Crow race or the Tour Croatia. Overall, tuned up nicely and will...
Well, what was this Crow race business? It reminded me, have you seen these things? I don't know, it's a London phenomenon, Crow Nuts? Half croissant, half donuts. You must have seen those.
I don't.
Right up your street.
I'm not sure it has anything to do with that, does it?
No, but it reminded me of that. Is this the official denomination of this race now, the Crow race?
I'm not sure it's got anything to do with crow nuts.
No. Daniel, while you've been in London, have you enjoyed any Caps and Cardi B's?
Oh, dear. No. Moving on, Napalm.
You're moving on to Berlin. Do they not tomorrow have a hipster scene there for
you? Oh, goodness. No. One or two hipsters there.
No crow nuts.
Their number is set to be swelled tomorrow.
Anyway, away from the racing, a little bit of transfer news to update on. Nasser Bouhanni and Dan McClay are moving to Arkea Samsic for next season. David de la Cruz is leaving Team Ineos to go to UAE Team Emirates. And Rowan Dennis's future is still up in the air. He left Bahrain when his contract was terminated before the World Championships, and that was kept very much under wraps so he could ride the World Championships in peace, prepare for it without being pestered about losing his position at Bahrain Merida.
Just on the Arkea recruitment, what kind of trident do you think the whimsical flaneur, the dandelion picker Warren Barguil, who's re-signed there, renewed there, Nairo Quintana and Bouhanni are going to form? That could be a bit of an incendiary mix, could it?
Well, I can't imagine that.
What a lead-out train that is for
the lead-out tram
for Bouhanni.
We remember from
Barguil and Nairo man
leading out Bouhanni. Yeah, could be more fisticuffs there. Anyway, on Rowan Dennis, he of course won the world time trial title on a BMC bike. A lot of speculation about where he'll end up. Latest hat to be thrown in the ring, not necessarily by them, but by others, Team Ineos. Could we see Rowan Dennis go to Team Ineos?
I think there are only two hats in the ring from what I've heard. CCC, I think he had some kind of discussion with them. So that's essentially his former team, sponsored by BMC, although they won't. No, they're not sponsored by BMC anymore. BMC, of course, were sponsored by BMC, surprisingly. But I think, yeah, Ineos could be the favourites now. But
Movistar, is that a non-starter?
I would suggest it's a non-starter. I don't have any solid information on that, but I think he's had some offers, definitely some, but they're not nearly of the kind of order of what he was earning at Bahrain Merida.
Well, we know Rod Ellingworth, who's now started work at Bahrain Merida, thanks to his role technically with McLaren, isn't it? We know that Ellingworth wanted to keep Dennis, but that was unsuccessful. Ellingworth has been busy recruiting people to the team set up. Roger Hammond, who was last working with Dimension Data, of course, will be
Madison
there.
Madison Genesis. He was running Madison Genesis this year. He went back there after Dimension Data.
Cut that out of the equation. I'm referring to his last world tour position. And also Tim Harris is going to be doing sort of talent spotting, future prospects identification. Obviously very familiar with Tim Harris's work nurturing riders over in Belgium.
Well, if you want to know more about Tim Harris, go back to last year's Friends special released around Easter time, where I spent some time with Tim Harris and in the house where he accommodates lots of young riders.
I was going to say, Tim Harris is scouting, or had this been a few years ago, all Tim Harris would have needed to do to scout some budding talent would be check who's sleeping in his spare room. He's had a few good riders in there.
He has, yeah.
A bit of a revolving door as well. Quite high turnover, I think. There have been a lot of riders through there over the years.
And lastly, although it's not confirmed yet, it looks very much like the Israel Cycling Academy Katusha merger, takeover, call it what you will, is going to happen. Yet to get confirmation fully on that regarding the World Tour license, but that looks almost certain. And, the one big question mark about that will be which riders do they retain from the respective teams. And, it's very late in the day for those who don't make the cut to find something else for 2020, but we will keep an eye on that in the coming weeks.
One little final one, Mark Cavendish to Barry Morita, are we expecting that? There's been lots of rumours just last few days.
Done deal, I think.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful to them as ever for their support. And we enjoyed being in the Rafa Cafe, Rafa Pop-Up in Harrogate during the World Championships. A great place to watch some racing this weekend. Of course, we've got Il Lombardia on Saturday and Paris-Tours on Sunday. So if you want to watch it in a lively place, find your nearest Rafa Cafe. They're all over the world. Now, Daniel, or Daniele Friberencini, as I keep trying to remember to call you. Some sad news, and news with which you have a personal connection.
Yeah, well, the old owner of the Mapei company, Giorgio Squinzi, died last week after he's been suffering from cancer for a while, for a few months, I think. Mapei, I think most people know, was the dominant team in cycling in the late 90s and early noughties, and a team that really, well, it's in that group of teams, a sort of half dozen teams, which you would say really marked the history of professional cycling, left a very deep imprint on the history of professional cycling. I worked for Mapei on, in two separate stints, towards the tail end of the sponsorship. So, for 6 months or so in, I think, 2000, and another similar period in 2002, just when they were about to shut down, essentially. But a team that started in 1993. They sort of saved this the old Eldor team, which was having financial difficulties. And Squinzi had been passionate about cycling his whole life. His dad was a huge cycling fan. And it was a company that really was sort of typical of, a phenomenon known in Italy as the Italian economic miracle, these sort of medium-sized kind of manufacturing companies. Mapei made chemical adhesives and grouts, and went from quite a small operation to one of the world leaders in that particular industry, and the cycling team was instrumental in that. They started off as quite a small outfit, but then within a year or two, a year, they were sort of targeting victory in the Tour de France with Tony Rominger, and great success in the Grand Tours didn't elude them. Rominger won the Giro and the Vuelta, but they were never able to win the Tour de France. But Squinzi became this sort of doyen, this kind of Zeus figure, especially in the company. He was talked about in these kind of reverential tones. When I used to work there, he would be sort of up on the where he worked on the top floor of the building in Milan, of the head office in Milan. And as I said, this sort of godlike presence in the company, and at the same time, someone who was who had great people skills, was widely admired. You'd bump into him in the lift, and what he would mainly want to talk about would be cycling. And this sort of passion, this connection with cycling and the team, really sort of infused and infected the whole company. And it was a company that under normal circumstances wouldn't have been the most glamorous to work for. You know, as I said, chemical adhesives, not the kind of thing that's a great icebreaker at a dinner party. But what everyone was proud of, and everyone did talk about on a Monday morning, that, you know, the first topic of conversation would be how the team got on at the weekend. And, you know, you'd often get riders, so stars from the team, the famous classic riders, the Museus and Bartolis and Bettinis. They would be in the office for various reasons, come to see the Dottore. One of Rominger's old team bikes was set up on the turbo trainer in the company gym, in which, you know, the sort of secretary would use at lunchtime. So it was very much part of the culture of the company. And you know, it's a shame in a way that it didn't last longer. But Mappe got out of the sport in 2002, essentially because of doping. And Squinty was someone who had seen this sort of plague coming and developing in the mid 90s, the EPO plague. He tried to sort of stem it in probably the most difficult period in cycling history to do that. He tried to ban the sort of external coaches, Michele Ferrari, Luigi Cecchini. Hadn't had a whole lot of success doing that, I don't think. And I think, with Stefano Garzelli's positive test in the 2002 Giro, Squinty sort of realised that he was fighting a losing battle, and all of his efforts were coming to nothing. And, you know, particularly because he felt the UCI, the governing body at the time, was intransigent, and he'd had his run-ins with Lance Armstrong as well, and he tried to sort of decry Lance Armstrong, and that had really... had no effect on the way the sport was going and the way the Tour de France was going in particular. And you know, he stuck to his guns and sort of resigned himself to the fact that he wasn't going to be able to change it from the inside. And ultimately, his sporting interest and Mappe's sporting interest veered away from cycling towards professional football, and he took the Sassuolo team, which was a very small team based near Reggio Emilia in the centre of Italy. He took them to Serie A over the sort of last 15 years of his life, which was, you know, his second great triumph in the sporting arena.
I mean, that was the impression when the team did fold, that he was reluctantly stepping away, that he felt, you know, it wasn't that the team came to a natural end, or that he fell out of love with cycling, or perhaps he did, but you felt that it was kind of throwing his hands up in defeat in a way, because clearly his passion for cycling remained. I mean, Mappe, very visible at the World Championships, they've been a sponsor of the World Championships for several years, so his interest in cycling obviously remained. But I think the impression at the time was that, you know, he was sort of admitting defeat in his efforts to run a clean team and change the sport.
Yeah, I think it was. And I think, as I say, over the late 90s, his sort of illusions about what was going on in the sport and what he hoped for the sport and for the team were sort of slowly shattered. There was a famous incident in the 1996 Giro when the Mappe leader, Abraham Alano, had sort of lost time on the first mountain stage to Monte Sirino, and he phoned up one of the directors sportifs, and Squinty says, well, you know, what's going wrong? How come Alano can't follow? And the director replied, well, what can we do? His hematocrit's only 52. And 52 was already over the limit that was going to be introduced at the end of that year of 50. But the assumption was that some of the riders Alano was up against were sort of a 56, 60, and probably risking their lives at that level. But, you know, Squinty, as I said, he tried to sort of stick his finger in the dike and at least run a clean team himself, but I think he realised that even that was impossible, you know, with the Garzelli incident, which, you know, initially he defended Garzelli, but I think he admitted to me in an interview years later he had doubts about whether Garzelli had been wrongly condemned. And I think with hindsight, if he was honest with himself, he would probably have admitted that he had doubts about a lot of his team in the late 90s, because they were very successful in a team in an era when, to be successful, you really had to sort of keep up with the doping Joneses.
I mean, De Koon and Quickstep are not direct descendants of Mapei, but there was a branch of the team that sort of, you know, shot up elsewhere in Belgium under Patrick Lefebvre, who worked at Mapei, and that team kind of carried on the torch in a way, and it's in a similar mould, isn't it, in the types of races that they contest and even the types of riders they have.
Yeah, very much so. And there are, you know, quite a number of, well, staff members who were at Mapei who are still at De Koon, not just Patrick Lefebvre.
Just you mentioned about the sort of the impact that Mapei tried to have on the Grand Tours. Didn't win the Tour de France, as you said, but did win one Giro and one Vuelta. Really, it was in the classics, and particularly Paris-Roubaix, that Mapei's jersey was. It was ominously masked at the front on several occasions. They did the 1-2-3 in 96, 98 and 99, I think. There's, of course, the famous story about the 96 edition where three Mapei riders broke away, and Giorgio Squinzi got on the phone to Patrick Lefebvre and they sorted out the finishing order. Squinzi particularly wanted Johan Museo to win the race. Patrick Lefebvre talks about that incident in our lunch with episode, or coffee with Patrick Lefebvre episode for Friends of the Podcast that came out at the start of the year. But they were a real powerhouse in the classics, and particularly Paris-Roubaix and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, when, well, in the early days they had Michele Bartoli and then Paolo Bettini and Frank Vandenbroek, of course. Well, he started off with Lotto, didn't he, but then was passed through Mapei on his way off to Cofidis, I think he went.
I think that was a good example, Lionel, of the extent to which the company, its messaging, its values were integrated in those of the team. The 1996 Paris-Roubaix, when I think when the phone call was taking place with Lefebvre, Squinzi had this kind of motto, the company motto, in his mind, which was Vincere Insieme. This was before the age of kind of slightly naff contrived hashtags, but he was sort of visualizing the posters that he was going to put up all around the head office in Milan of these three riders coming over, the three Mapei riders coming over the line together, and sure enough, you know, that was an image that was used for years thereafter.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Stitch Fix. Basically, a personal stylist who will select items of clothing for you without you having to go anywhere or more or less do anything. You just complete a style quiz on the website. Your personal stylist will then send you 5 items of clothing, each hand-picked for you from a selection of over 100 best European brands, including established names and cool emerging designers and exclusive brands. You try everything on at home. You decide what you want to keep. If you don't want a particular item, you can send them back. And it's low risk. For your stylist time, you pay a £10 styling charge, which is deducted from the cost of anything you do decide to buy. Well, Richard, you got your first delivery from Stitch Fix a little while ago, didn't you?
Yeah, well, you do the style quiz online, Lionel, as you know, and then you're shown some pictures of outfits, and you pick the ones you like and the ones you don't like. It was a very new experience for me. I've had a box with 5 items, you know, a mix, trousers, T-shirt, shirt. I mean, what did you think of my shirt on Sunday night? We did an event at a book festival on Sunday night, and I wore my quite flamboyant, for me, shirt.
Well, this was a thing. I don't think you would have picked that shirt had you been in a shop. But
never.
I thought, yeah, I mean, I don't want to...
this is awkward, isn't it? This is going to be...
I don't want to flatter you for any reason, but it looked good.
Thank you, Lionel. That was difficult for you, I know.
But it takes all of that kind of risk out of things, doesn't it? You don't have to try something on in the shop.
Well, the thing I hate is trousers. I hate trying on trousers in shops. Taking your shoes off, putting the trousers on, putting your shoes on again, taking your shoes off again, taking the trousers off, putting another pair. It's awful. So it's very easy. And they're definitely, you know, it's a mix of items. I sent a couple of things back, you know, a couple of things didn't fit me properly. There was one polo shirt I got which I wasn't too keen on, you know, I kept three out of the five items, which is pretty good hit rate, I think.
Well, the idea came from a Harvard graduate, Katrina Lake, who wanted to help people dress well without having to go through the pain of the shopping. Also, when you buy stuff online, sometimes the sizes can be inconsistent. Stitch Fix know how the various different brands all measure up against one another, so they can avoid sending you things that aren't going to fit too well. So if that sounds like the sort of thing you want to check out, go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. That's Stitch Fix, stitchfix.co.uk/cycling.
Well, Lionel, last week Daniel and I took ourselves off to meet with Graham Bartlett, the chief executive at Velon. Velon is the organisation it doesn't represent the teams, it's owned by 11 of the World Tour teams. Can you name them all?
Quite,
while you're thinking about that,
I know De Koninck, Quickstep, Ineos, Jumbo Visma, Bora Hansgrohe, plus another seven.
EF Sunweb, Education First, Sunweb,
yep. Mitchelton Scott, EF Education First, Lotto Soudal, Trek Segafredo, UAE Team Emirates, and CCC.
Well done, Lionel. Excellent. They were in the news a few days after the World Championships finished. We learned that they had filed an antitrust complaint with the European Commission about the UCI. And it really centres on two things. The UCI are trying to prevent them using the word series in there to describe their Hammer Series. They don't like the idea. Well, while the UCI have got their own reforms, and they want to introduce new series themselves, they don't want companies like Velon to run competitions that form part of an overall series. One-off races appear to be fine. So that's one area of dispute. Another area of dispute is about data and in-race data and who owns the data, whether it's the organisers and by implication the UCI or Velon. And Velon have previously argued and won the case that they and the teams and the riders own that data and can use it and monetize it as they see fit. So these are the two areas of dispute, really, with the UCI. Curiously, I mean, the complaint was filed actually some time ago. The UCI claim not to have been informed about this complaint yet, officially. Both parties complain that the other side hasn't been speaking to them. So there's a breakdown in communication here, and it could be quite messy. It could also be quite long, because it could be years before this is resolved. And it's, you know, I think Velon have been around for 5 years now. Graham Bartlett's been the chief executive throughout. They've definitely made some progress in terms of they've organised the Hammer Series. It's been running for a few years now. They have been using data in races. They've been pioneering that, really. They own some rights to races, to broadcast races. They even sort of organise races, other races as well. So they're a growing organisation. I think some people are probably still confused about what they do and what their mission is. And these are some of the questions we asked Graham.
And Rich, we should also point out that Velon's complaint, or the case that they filed with the European Commission, has been sort of augmented or followed by another complaint against the UCI to the European Commission. Today we understand the Lega Pro, the Italian Cycling League, has also made a complaint about the UCI, suggesting that the UCI is not acting in the role of a regulator, and it's pursuing kind of entrepreneurial interests. And the kernel of this complaint seems to be this prospect of there only being, we think, one wildcard team at some of the World Tour races next year, and particularly the major tours. And this, of course, it could mean that at the Giro d'Italia next year, there's only one Italian team.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear what Graham Bartlett has to say. But just before we do, I mean, my main observation is that the Hammer Series came along in 2017. The first one was in Limburg in the Netherlands, and it was really interesting to watch. I remember being kind of confused by the concept, but then got my head around it as the race went on. Clearly an innovative idea, very a very telegenic type of spectacle. And they branched out from Limburg, and they've held events in Stavanger in Norway and Limburg each year since. And then they added Hong Kong. This year's Hong Kong event was due to be held this weekend, but as I said earlier, that's not going to take place. The problem that the Hammer Series races have is they're trying to trying to make some headway, trying to grab attention in a crowded, confused, muddled calendar, particularly holding a Hammer Series event while the Giro is going on, has been the case for the last couple of years. It, not really giving the Hammer Series much of a chance to get any kind of coverage recognition. And I think that, you know, this dispute between Velon, which is effectively just over half of the World Tour teams, and the UCI, in a way, is a kind of continuation of a sort of decade or so long dispute between the major stakeholders that's just been rumbling away. The teams versus the UCI, the UCI versus ASO, the teams versus ASO, in a sort of an uneasy triangle. And this is just the latest flare-up, it seems to me.
And the difference this time being that the suspicion is that ASO and the UCI are in league via the relationship between the UCI president, David Lapartient, who of course is French, and ASO, which is in contrast to the situation where the war that went on for a few years in the mid-noughties, where it was ASO very much versus the UCI.
Well, Graham, the news came out this week that Velon has reported the UCI to the European Commission. Can you tell us what the nature of the complaint, first of all?
It's nice to be back on podcast. It's been a while. Good to see you both. Yeah, we filed an antitrust complaint to the European Commission against the UCI. We did that with the unanimous support of all of our shareholder teams. I think it's important to stress that this is not an action that Velon takes on lightly, and it's done by all the people who own us, which are our teams. The reason for the complaint is the UCI's use of its regulatory powers to the detriment of the team's business and to favour the UCI's and others' business interests. That's the essence of it. In the past year, we feel that the UCI has tried to stop what Velon and the teams have pioneered in the sport. We pioneered a new format of racing, as you know, the Hammer Series, pioneered a lot of new technology. And previously with the UCI, they'd supported these initiatives, but in the last 12 months, we found that they've used their regulatory power and their political leverage to try and frustrate these business activities of Velon and the teams in what we believe is an incorrect and unlawful manner. So that's the reason for the filing of the complaint.
And to get to this point, you said, you know, it's a last resort, I suppose. Dialogue must have been attempted and broken down, presumably.
Yes, I mean, our whole business operation within Velon is based around collaboration. You know, we collaborate with teams that are not shareholders, we collaborate with races, we work in partnership with lots of different companies. And that's the essence of our business, because we believe that the way the sport will move forward is by more of the stakeholders working more closely together. But with the UCI, we found, despite repeated attempts to, one, remind them that certain things do exist within the company. We do have an exclusive license from all our shareholding teams to pioneer the data technology in the race. That's not, you know, something we made up. It's a fact. We've traded that to lots of people. We have created a new race series. The UCI are well aware of that because they helped us to work on it originally. So these are things that they're very well aware of. But when we've tried to talk to them in the last 12 months about our concerns about some of the things that they were doing, we've been effectively told that, you know, this is, we're not a stakeholder, we don't have any standing, and the UCI is not interested in discussing the issues and the problems we've highlighted. So that's caused a great deal of frustration. And in the end, the teams felt, look, we just don't have any choice here. We can't be in a situation where the UCI believes it can be the regulator of the sport, but also take new business away from the teams and the riders and use its regulatory powers for its own commercial benefit and to take those rights from the teams and riders without consultation or permission. So we didn't take the matter lightly, but yeah, it's been a frustration for quite a long time.
Graham, they seem to have taken particular issue with the Hammer series and you calling it a series. You obviously want to expand that series. There were plans for, well, unfortunately you've had to cancel the race in Hong Kong, but what is their issue, do you think, with the notion of a rival body setting up a series of races?
I don't know, because they haven't told us, Daniel, unfortunately. We pioneered this series as a series. I mean, we all know, and everybody sees the reports that come out, whether it's the RAFA roadmap or indeed the UCI's own survey of the fans, it would be great if the sport had more narrative story to its season. And that's the very essence of what we're trying to do with Hammer. And we know that there's a UCI regulation which says that the UCI can bestow that moniker upon a race series. But there are lots of other race series. There's several in Europe and in France there's one in Italy as well. There's a pan-European one. So it's good for the sport. Let's build narrative. We all agree with that. So they told us back in February the races, Hammer races, may not be referred to as a series under UCI regulations, but no explanation has ever been given. And Velon and the teams competing in the Hammer events continued to race for the series because it's one of the key features of the new races, despite the fact that the UCI said that they may refuse to register Hammer races in the future if we do that. But no explanation has ever been given as to why the races shouldn't be a series.
I mean, a lot of people have sort of interpreted it as an argument over the use of a word, but clearly it's a lot more than that. And the implication is that it looks, you know, like the UCI are trying to stop Velon from promoting these events. Is that also your understanding? And why would they be wanting to stop them?
So it is definitely our understanding, because they've written to us and told us that it should not be referred to as a series. And is a particular word important? Well, the word in itself isn't, but the actual concept is. If we all believe there's a strength in a narrative and a season-long story, then of course you want to tell that story. And the way you do it is by saying this is a series. Hammer Stavanger, points at Hammer Limburg, points at Hammer Hong Kong, and the finale is in Hammer Hong Kong. So that's different from saying there's a race in Norway, there's a race in the Netherlands, and there's a race in Hong Kong. It's a totally different thing. You completely change the nature of what you're doing if it's a series or if it's not.
You so call it the Hammer League.
I don't know whether the objection is for the particular word, but yeah, it's an interesting idea that, Richard. Maybe we'll just swap words. But we've carried on calling it a series because that is what it is, and we haven't heard any justification for it not to be. And because it's the very nature of what it is and what makes it appealing, who's going to win in Hong Kong? Who's winning after Stavanger? Who's winning after Limburg? And who's going to win in Hong Kong? That is your story. So if you take that away, you're just left with another bunch of what I would argue is very exciting races. But it doesn't have the special flavour of it being a series, which is what everybody in the sport is saying we should do. And we've done it. And now a governing body's saying you can't. So without telling us why.
Graham, I think it's 5 years now since Velon launched. And I guess the perception of the fan is that there's this organisation which intended to change the sport fundamentally, the way the fans consume it. And, in various different ways with data and, more unity for the teams. People probably think that the big changes are still a way downstream, that they think that there's this organisation that's plotting something and it's going to be important, but it's not necessarily achieved that position yet, but it might. Do you think the UCI is more worried about where you want to get to than what you're doing as an organisation now and the way you're trying to influence and improve the sport as it is now?
I don't know what the UCI is worried about because they haven't told us. So I can't speak to that. I do know that what we are doing, when they did their last fan survey, it came back that people were in favour of more exciting racing, more narrative in the season, and more ways of showing the race in cool, new, interesting ways. All of those things are at the heart of what we're trying to achieve. So it would seem the UCI's own survey says that we're doing the right thing. How much have we achieved in 5 years? We would like to have done a lot more. Of course we would. I mean, you always want to move faster. But I think if I look at our Palmeiras, it's pretty good. I mean, I'm obviously going to say that because I'm partly responsible for the work that's done. But we created a new style of racing. The sport hadn't seen a new format of racing in its recent modern history. We brought a whole different set of technology to racing that doesn't actually exist in any other sport. Never mind cycling. You can't get the biometric performance live out of the event in the NFL or the ATP or the Premier League. You can if you've got the technology that Velon uses at your race, like they do in London, like we do in the UEA Tour, and like we do in the Giro d'Italia. So I think we've achieved quite a lot against our objectives to entertain the fans and bring more of the excitement of the race to the fans. Our big goal is to change the economic model. Have we achieved that? No. We've seen it shift, because shifting an economic model that's been there for pretty much 100 years is not an easy thing to do. But we've definitely seen movement in this, because race organisers, whether it's the Tour of Guangxi, whether it's Ride London, whether it's the UAE Tour, whether it's Flanders Classics, have looked at what we're doing and say, hang on a minute, we should collaborate better and more strongly with this, because we've both got a common interest that we should make the product, the sport, because it is a product. I mean, people shouldn't be ashamed of talking about this in commercial terms. It's a professional business and it needs to be treated that way. And we make no shame of being a commercial organisation, because we're proud of that. You're working in a professional sport. You should be professional and commercial. So those organisers and other partners have come to us and said, look, we agree with the way this should work to make the sport more appealing. We need to grow the fan base. We need a younger fan base. Because if you're going to be professional and if you're going to generate revenue and income, you need to expand that fan base. There needs to be more people excited and attracted to watching and consuming your sport. It's what drives everything. So have we moved the economic model? Yes. Have we got it to where we want it to be? No, because the stability for the stakeholders within the sport remains incredibly fragile. And that applies to teams and a lot of races as well. And we've been adamant since the very beginning that the way to change that is to come together and produce a better race that the fans can look at and see more of, and enjoy and be excited, inspired by in a much more impactful way. That's why we set up Hammer, because we think that's a really appealing, different type of racing that can be grabbed by people. Of course, you're going to have the monuments and the Grand Tours. Absolutely. Where would you ever be without those guys? They're great, great races. But for a younger demographic and a different fan base, let's have another colour in the palette here rather than another stage race or another one-day race. So we brought that for exactly the same reasons. Bring more of the excitement of racing to the fans in a way that they can look at impact racing 2 hours a day over a weekend in one location, so you can all come together and really see the sport. And then with the existing races, we pioneered not just data technology, but video technology. We worked with ASO, put cameras on bikes. Then we worked with RCS to do the data that we've done in the Giro. So let's pull more of the excitement out from there. We're now distributing broadcast rights. Velon is now a media distributor for certain races for their broadcast rights. So only yesterday we did a Munsterland, and we did over 140,000 views on a streaming feed for them, which is internationally, that's very impressive. Munsterland doesn't get that kind of audience internationally normally, because there can be a demand there. And working with Velon to distribute that, of course, the teams who are in the race help to push the feed, which is great for the race. So we've gone into lots of different areas around what we can do with existing races to make it more exciting and impactful for the fans. And we've set up a new one.
Punch up after the race always
happens. I don't know if that really
two Velon teams. Two Velon teams.
Yeah, we arranged that. Yeah, say, guys, what we need for a new audience is to have a fight after the race. No, it was. I don't even know if we featured it in the stream. I hope we didn't, because then we can say it was nothing to do with us, because it clearly wasn't. But yeah, that's a lot of races don't have international coverage. And we're sitting there with the teams saying, look, you can help them. You can help them get international coverage, because you can promote the fact that you're there to your fans and you can promote to those fans where to see that race. You know, we all know that the revolution in sport is coming through, you know, streaming and OTT and being able to consume it on different media and being able to see this wherever you want, anywhere in the world, on any device. And cycling is a sport that really should embrace that, because if you want to reach a new audience, you've got to go where they are. You can't say, no, you have to go to me. It doesn't work that way anymore. So for all of the races that we're talking to, we'd love to do more distribution with you. We'd love to promote your international coverage and help you distribute that. And Munsterland has hopefully, I think, I haven't spoken to the race, but I'm hoping they're very happy with what we've done there, because 140,000 international views is probably a lot more than some sporting events get that people think are a lot bigger.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. We're going to look ahead to Il Lombardia, which I was very tickled earlier to hear Daniel calling the Tour of Lombardy.
Yeah, well,
they rebranded it, didn't they?
Well, it's funny, we were talking about the series and the UCI's issue with the word series. Well, I know that we've probably mentioned this before, but RCS rebranded a few of its races a few years ago to get rid of any reference to the word Giro, apart from in the Giro d'Italia, which is why it ceased to be the Giro di Lombardia and became Il Lombardia, which I find a bit newfangled and naff. So I continue to call it Tour of Lombardy.
Well, the next item that nicely introduces something that I must admit, Lionel, the complexity of this sends my brain into kind of haywire.
Well,
I want a briefing. Give me a briefing. Dummy's guide to what's going on here.
So, Richard, I'm sure all of the listeners out there...
Let's try not to be facetious at any point in this.
No, I'm not going to be facetious at all.
I know you're not.
I'm sure the listeners out there have got me pegged as some kind of granddaddish, fuddy-duddy fogey who wouldn't understand indoor cycling on computers. But I've used Zwift for a couple of winters now. For those who don't know, you hook up your smart turbo trainer to a computer, and Zwift is a virtual world of courses. Recently you could ride the Harrogate World Championship course, for example. Watopia is their virtual world of Zwift, and it's a really handy training tool. A lot of professional riders use it as well, don't they? And with the world rushing headlong towards the realm of esports, it's no surprise that cycling is to cycling credit really that they're among the vanguard of this movement, I think.
You say that movement, the world rushing to kind of embrace esports, napalm, but don't want to put you on the spot too much. But what in which sports which shadow sports have esports, the world of esports, has it punched a real hole? I mean, in football, I know there are professional clubs now that have a sort of a satellite or shadow esports club, and they recruit players and they pay money for players. But what are the other big ones?
I mean,
over to you, Buffalo.
No, I don't know, but of all of them, I do think cycling has the greatest potential in a way, because I don't know enough about the others, but I see with cycling that it's still the physical aspect remains, whereas some other esports there isn't that physical aspect.
Well, I think that's there's a lot of these kind of shooting games that people play in organized kind of competitions, and this is so far out of my my area of interest, but the football one is an interesting comparison, because the computer game FIFA is obviously licensed by the football's world governing body, and so there's already a very strong relationship there. And if you have satellite TV, you may have seen people playing FIFA computer game football being broadcast on television. Not something that I want to sit and watch, but, you know, it's clearly popular. I think cycling and I think rowing are a little slower to get their act together, but they're the two which most readily combine the athletic aspect and the kind of the virtual gaming aspect. Anyway, the story that's really rocked the world of e-racing is that at the inaugural British Esports Cycling Championships in March, the winner, Cameron Jeffers, pocketed his £400 prize for the men's event. There was a men's and a women's event. He pocketed his £400 prize, a virtual national championships jersey and a real national championship jersey made out of material that he could actually wear in real life. So he said, not to be facetious, I'm trying hard here, but there is
haven't seen a picture of this, but did it have does it have any kind of distinguishing kind of emblem on the front in the same way the time trial one does?
No, it doesn't. Anyway,
like
somebody,
Space Invader, somebody in the middle of the rainbow stripes.
No. There isn't a little Pac-Man logo going across the jersey. No, come on, back to the serious subject here. Now, if you've not ridden on Zwift before, you won't perhaps know that as you sign up, you start on the basic virtual bike with the basic virtual kit. And as you clock hours or kilometres, you unlock faster wheels, faster helmets. You can customise your jerseys and so on.
It's really hard not to be facetious. Basically, as you kind of lurch further and further into your midlife crisis, you've got... it's the equivalent of spending more and more money on carbon wheels and, you know, this.
Only you're spending time, aren't you? Not money.
Yeah, quite. And you're progressing through the game.
Yeah,
and
you're earning them.
There's a whole network and program of races. You can race round the clock if you want against other people who are also in their office or garage or home gym riding on the Zwift. So there's a real community aspect to it as well. Anyway, the issue of the controversy was that someone tipped off British Cycling, who have taken esports under their wing and are have kind of made themselves the governing body of the sport. Somebody tipped off British Cycling that Cameron Jeffers, the winner, had better choose my words slightly carefully here, but basically skipped the process to earn the fastest bike on Zwift, the Z1 concept bike. And basically, to get the Z1 concept bike, to unlock it, you have to complete a really significant athletic challenge. Basically, you have to ride Everest plus about another 15,000 meters of climbing. And he hacked into the system. I'm trying to keep the language simple here. He hacked into the system to set his account to clock up the required meters of climbing without him actually having to do the pedaling. So he effectively dishonestly acquired the virtual the virtual bike that does give an advantage, an athletic advantage in the video game. Now BC contacted him and he denied it initially, and then British Cycling and Zwift worked together because they can access the data. And it turned out that his account had been logged on in multiple locations, including Denmark and Plymouth, at the same time, so that his account was clocking up the climbing. His weight had been reduced down to 45 kilograms, and it had been set to ride at 2,000 watts for 200 kilometers to unlock the bike. So far, so straightforward. In the end, he accepted a specified sanction of 6 months, the £250 fine, and was stripped of the title. And that title has gone to the runner-up, whose name is James Phillips. And I gather from British Cycling's point of view, they wanted to establish right at the outset, we're really at the very beginning of this crossover into computer gaming and athletic achievement. They really wanted to establish that these are proper competitions and that the rules have to be respected. There is a bit of debate about whether there was a specific rule determining how you acquire the in-game upgrades, but British Cycling's point of view is that they're right from the very beginning, right from December 2018, it was made clear that basically you have to compete honestly. The right thing to have done would have been to say, look, I didn't acquire this bike by pedalling, so I won't use it in the competition. And so that is where we stand. But for me, it really opens a very interesting world, because there'll be an e-racing world championships next year. The UCI and Zwift have joined forces so that there's going to be a legitimate relationship between the game and the world governing body. And insiders reckon that esports will be part of the Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 2028.
Do we know what WADA's position on it is?
Well, funny you say that. The UK anti-doping were at the British Cycling Esports Championships to take samples.
But presumably, you know, WADA have not mandated this. And, I mean, does the WADA code have any validity when applied to this? I mean, everything that UK anti-doping does should be under the auspices of the WADA code.
I think we're in very early stages of all of this being ironed out, and you know, they're, it's going step by step. But in order to be in the Olympics, then the athletes would have to be subject to exactly the same anti-doping rules and regulations and testing as riders competing outdoors on the road.
I mean, I'm not facetious about this at all, actually. I said at the end of the World Championships that we went to the Zwift draft house one night, and there were races every night with some of the riders who'd been crowned world champion that day or the day before, and there was a great atmosphere there, and I could see the appeal of that of not replacing road racing or time trialing, but as a sort of extra element meant the World Championships left a sort of bigger footprint in Harrogate and gave people things to do and things to watch, and gave them a real close up view of world champions. But also the social aspect to it, which sounds kind of paradoxical, contradictory, but that I haven't done that myself. I've gone and ridden, you know, some of these routes, including the World Championship course from last year, the Innsbruck one, which I enjoyed. But, you know, meeting up with people, you've done that, have you not, Lionel?
Yeah. In terms of making it a spectator sport, I'm not sure I'd want to watch it on television. I didn't watch it at the time, I must admit, when it was on.
No, I'm thinking more live event.
Yeah, but as a live event, I could see it being... I'm very interested in the PDC darts, where they hire convention centres and lay out all the tables. I mean, without wanting to kind of reduce it to a lowest common denominator, the one thing about the Zwift draft house in... Harrogate was that, you know, people were having a beer, there was a real kind of raucous atmosphere. I think Pete Kenyon was doing the DJing, you know, so there was an atmosphere in there which really worked in a small confined hothouse type venue. Whether that would then transfer to a big arena, it might well do. People watch the darts. I mean, the dartboard's only a foot and a half across, isn't it? And they watch it from right at the back of the room on big screens. I could possibly see the O2 hosting the British Cycling Championships.
Sawdust
in the
on
future.
The floor.
I think one of the intriguing things and almost unique things about cycling is the different elements that kind of make up everyone's kind of interest in the sport. If you think of your own sort of personal interest in the sport, it's kind of like a pie chart, and for some people that the portion of their interest that comes from the sort of outdoors element to it, or the adventure element of it, is huge. For other people, you know, they're mainly interested in equipment, physiology, the social aspect of it, all of, you know, and those boxes are ticked by this, but it's not going to be for everyone, is it? I mean, for me, it overlaps to a certain extent with track racing, which has never really particularly captured my interest. It's probably less for me than it would be for some other people.
I completely agree with you. I mean, I enjoy riding on Zwift during the winter because I think it's a good way to get some exercise without going outdoors. The gaming aspect of it is fun, you know, when you're taking part in it. I think that in the racing, you know, there's a few loopholes that people can exploit just in the kind of the casual racing, just by lowering their weight so that their little avatar performs better, which I think, you know, that sort of detracts a little bit. That's why I wouldn't necessarily take the racing side of it seriously, notwithstanding the fact that I'm not good enough anyway. But I think just because I'm not interested in it doesn't mean that it could go on to be an absolute phenomenon. I mean, Cameron Jeffers, he issued an explanation for his cheating, on his YouTube channel, and he's got 50,000 subscribers. Now, just because that's not the world that I'm interested in doesn't mean it's not going to be a world that particularly not going to be a world that could be monetized quite significantly, because I think there's a lot of commercial interest in this kind of world. Just very lastly, I mean, we're going to look at the e-racing phenomenon, I think, perhaps in the regular podcast, but also in Service Course as our series continues and develops. But my last point about this for now would be that the really important thing to establish in terms of championship racing right now is this an athletic endeavour or is it a game? If it's an athletic endeavour, there doesn't seem to be any justification for having people on different types of virtual equipment. And that might sound a little bit odd because obviously in physical racing, the equipment is actually quite important and everyone isn't all on a standard bike. But I'm just not sure that for me, in terms of sort of the watching it or the kind of the storytelling aspect of it, I'm just not sure there's really a justification for saying, well, that person's on slightly quicker pixels than that person. That doesn't work for me.
Good point. Lionel, you mentioned service course and episode 3 of that will come out next week. And we've got a new presenter, Lizzie Banks, the Bigla rider who kept an excellent audio diary for us at the Giro Rosa with Tom Whalley. That's coming out next week. I've had a listen to the episode. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a really, really interesting subject. It's all about how the world has been designed for and by men and how that affects cycling, bikes, clothing. Really, really interesting. Not something I'd thought about before, about data bias and all that. And really, really interesting. Highly recommend. That comes out next week. And if indoor entertainment is your thing, don't forget our November tour is coming up. In 11th of November, we kick off in Bristol at St. George's Hall. 12th of November in Cardiff. 13th of November at Worcester. 14th of November, Dublin. 15th, Belfast. Then the 18th, London, the Arts Theatre in London. And also the 25th at the Arts Theatre in London. And then Cambridge on the 26th, Edinburgh on the 27th, Leicester on the 28th, and Manchester on the 30th. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com and live events. So you click on the live events tab there, and that'll take you to the page from which you can buy tickets. Now, this weekend, Il Lombardia on Saturday. I'm going to be there, actually. I'm going out there on a secret mission, but that will be for a friend's special coming up later on. What do we, last year's winner Thibaut Pinot missing, obviously he's cut the season short, so has Julian Alaphilippe, who obviously hasn't quite been himself maybe since the Tour de France and his exploits there. He's not riding. Philippe Gilbert is, Vincenzo Nibali, Adam Yates, you mentioned, Lionel, what are you thinking? Daniel starts in Bergamo this year, finishes in Como.
Well, I think the big form rider is Primoz Roglic, isn't it? The winner of the Giro dell'Emilia, ticks all the boxes, is, you know, has a team that is very strong on the climbs. They've managed to sort of, well, tease out the last droplets of energy of a few of their riders. A lot of that team finished the Vuelta very tired, but they've managed to kind of go again for these last end of season races, and I think they'll be pretty hard to beat. But I also think Adam Yates will be probably quite hard to beat, and Nibali as well. I think Nibali, when he finished the Tour de France, there were question marks about whether he would race again at all this year. I remember Chiro saying that he wanted to finish the Tour de France, or Chiro suspected he wanted to finish the Tour de France, mainly so that he could sort of call it a day for the year, but that hasn't happened, has it? So I think he'll be strong as well. One of the sort of traditional decisive climbs that's gone in and out of the route over the last 15 or 20 years, the San Fermo della Battaglia climb, is back in the route, so it should be even more selective this year, and you would think that would favour a rider like Roglic, but also those other two that we mentioned, Yates and Nibali.
Yeah, a few other names to conjure with. Fausto Masnada, our old friend from the Giro. Jakob Fuglsang, Egan Bernal. There was another name as well that caught my eye as I scrolled through the sheet. Mike Woods and David Godu was another one, a teammate of Thibaut Pinot. Haven't seen a lot of him since the Tour de France, but he was very impressive there, and who knows, I mean, he'll probably be the team leader for Groupama FTJ.
Well, we're recording today, aren't we, Rich, before the Trevalli Varesine, and that in the last few years has been a very good gauge of who's still fresh enough to contend at Lombardy, so we'll be watching that with interest today.
And Godu was fourth actually at Bruno Baghelli a few days ago in a very, very strong field, so he might be going. Might be a decent shout. What? Who's your tip, Lionel? I know you like to speculate.
Well, yeah, my strong suit, isn't it? Speculation. I thought the Woods and Sergio Higuita finishing second and third at the Giro dell'Emilia was interesting, and that's quite a sort of quite a tandem. Those two, they're not going to be riding a tandem, obviously, but quite a duo. We'll see. It's a beautiful race to watch, though. That's
lovely.
The main thing.
Lovely. Looking forward to it.
Is this the first year that the Tour of Lombardy, Lombardia, and Paris Tour have been on the same weekend? I think it will be. It's very discombobulating.
Wonder if anyone will ride both.
Well, we'll see.
Killian Kelly will tell us on Sunday evening, if not before, I would imagine. Killian, if you're listening, do tell us. That.
Outsider, Rich, Giulio Ciccone.
There we go. Oh, well, on that note, shall we wrap things up? Daniel, bon voyage.
Thank you.
Good luck in Berlin. And Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.